This is Car Expert.
China's even bigger and richer than either of them, and the products are getting better at a rate of knots. Every other car brand better watch out.
The Jolyon actually puts up a really good fist of not only having the equipment, but making it attractive and making it work well.
This M-Hybrid stuff, it improves the smoothness of the drive because the stop-start is a bit nicer. But in terms of economy gains, there are none to be found.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner. How are you?
I'm very well. Hello, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy Turner, and happy birthday, Mike Costello.
Yes.
Thank you. And I like this weird trend that we've got where we're calling each other by our second names, even though we're a small company that don't really have replicated names. You know, I like it. It's good. And thank you. I'm joyfully working on my birthday, which probably says something about my priorities in life, doesn't it?
Have you got any presents yet?
No, half. When I go home, there will definitely be some waiting for me. I left early this morning, but many big plans over the next few days to enjoy turning 34, which is a pretty, you know, meaningless age as far as they go, but it's always delightful to turn over another year.
Tell you what though, make the most of an actual birthday where you can have people over or a certain amount of people over and you're not in the middle of lockdown.
So the fact that we're one of the only places in Australia that can go to a pub is an irony that's not lost on me considering what Victoria's been like up until now.
Yep. You are so, so right. Scully, you've been off gallivanting around Melbourne suburbs this week up to Epping, the northern parts of Melbourne. What were you doing up there?
So Epping is home to none of Melbourne's tourist attractions, now I think of it. But it is home also to Premcar, which is an Australian engineering firm that has done work on all sorts of really interesting cars before, including what is possibly the coolest ever Ford Falcon that was like a reimagined GTHO. But it also worked with Nissan on the Navara Pro 4X Warrior, which is essentially Nissan's locally engineered rival to the Ford Ranger Raptor. And they take a Pro 4X and then they rip out the suspension and put a whole new bespoke system on it. It's got a wider track and really clever upgrades we'll talk about more in news. But it's all been developed, tested and built by Premcar in Epping. And about 80% of the parts on this car, as of now, are Australian developed as well. So it's a really cool little Australian manufacturing story. And we first went a couple of years ago when the first Warrior was revealed. And there was a lot of, we're really happy about this. We've got some headroom. We're expanding our operations a little bit. And then in between then and now, Premcar's expanded again. And then talking to them this time, there's more headroom again if more brands want to work with them to expand their operations and just keep growing what is a really cool local manufacturing story. So it was awesome going to Epping and just kind of seeing that, like, we know Australians are good at engineering and building cars. It was cool to see it's actually still happening and it could grow again going forward, maybe in a different way to what we're used to.
So I think it's really interesting that, you know, obviously there is a really big presence among the automotive aftermarket. The average pickup truck buyer in Australia, you know, buys a Ranger or Hilux, whatever it is, spends a few grand at ARB or Ironman or one of those aftermarket providers, Pedders for suspension, and they're all brilliant. But if you want to do this officially through Nissan, well, as Premcar has, they need to produce a vehicle that is covered fully by Nissan's warranty, and they also need to meet all of Nissan's internal engineering requirements, which means that there's another level that has to be done here because the iterative changes that you're doing to all the spring suspension, bodywork, etc., they need to go through a lot more hoops, I suppose. And that doesn't mean they're better or worse, but it just means that there are more checks and balances. So I think this process, this can, you know, this work collaboration between a car brand and an independent engineering firm like this is a really smart way to do it. And, you know, we're already seeing a lot of other brands exploring this. Toyota does the Hilux Rugged X, which is an accessorized local product. And I think Australia's unique taste in pickups and utes means that this sort of thing is really going to get legs and it's going to become much more of a big thing as time goes on. Nissan expects, I think, Scully, what were they saying, 1,500 of these Navara Warriors a year they can produce, but wow, they can scale it up if they need to.
Yep.
Given something like 60% of all the utes sold are over 50 grand now, premium utes because of tax write-offs and things like that are really booming, I reckon they're going to do a heck of a lot more than that. And the current, you know, 6,500 square meter site with 35 staff could easily get scaled up to meet demand.
Absolutely. And we'll talk more about the car in the news section, but Nissan has proven that it can do it now. Premcar's proven it can do it with the success of the first Warrior. So I think from here it's onwards and upwards.
So we will get stuck into news. I know you could talk about this car all day, Mocha, because you have one. The 2021 Suzuki Jimny Lite. The pricing has been revealed for this. Oh, my God. I didn't think this car could get even more basic.
Yeah, so as a current Jimny owner, I know more than most just how basic the vehicle is. But the other thing about the Jimny is pretty much everybody who buys them modifies them, myself included. And so this Jimny Lite, as it's called, L-I-T-E, kind of taps into that. So Suzuki has taken away the LED headlights and replaced them with crappy old halogens. It's taken the alloy wheels away and replaced them with steel wheels, given you're probably going to put new wheels and tyres on anyway, what's the harm? And they've taken out the 7-inch touchscreen with CarPlay and Android Auto and sat-nav and replaced it with this old school button double DIN style, you know, system with Bluetooth. And they've taken $1,500 off the price to $26,990 before on road costs. The other thing is it's manual only. So there's no automatic option on this one, like on the normal Jimny, which kind of tells you a bit about the enthusiast buyer that's really targeted with this car. One of the really interesting sides to this story is we know that Jimny's waiting lists are through the roof, up to a year at times, generally more like 6 months. The company has put in a ton of, you know, new structures and features and programs behind the scenes to try and speed up the delivery of vehicles. The fact that it's been able to source this new Jimny option, this base Jimny option, will no doubt help the supply situation. But to give you an idea of demand, the company sold 100 in the first week before the pricing was announced and before any advertising begun. So, you know, this car, Suzuki honestly could charge $40,000 for it and they'd probably still sell them. And so some people in the comments were criticizing it because, you know, it's $26,990, it's only $1,500 cheaper and it's losing some good features, which I agree with. But at the same time, Suzuki can pretty much charge whatever the hell it wants.
It seems also like $1,500 off doesn't sound like much, but you're no exception to this. I know Jack Quick, who has contributed for Car Expert before, is the same. Pretty much everyone who buys a Jimny just ends up putting their own headlights, their own grille, their own wheels, all that stuff in there anyway. So $1,500 off the price, although it seems like a small reduction, it's just $1,500 more in your pocket to then spend on the modifications you'd otherwise buy anyway. So
that'll get you 5 BF Goodrich all-terrains.
Spoken
like a true owner.
So, Moko, what if you're waiting in the queue for the standard Jimny, but all of a sudden you want the lights?
Yeah.
Is there a way around that?
Yeah, well, Suzuki would be delighted because that means that there's, you know, they can shuffle somebody else up the queue. But no, unfortunately, you've got to go back. So there's two separate queues. There's one for the normal Jimny and one for the light. So if you were to say, hey, I think I want the light now, you would have to cancel your order and then go into the light queue. As it stands, the queue for the light is going to be a lot shorter than the queue for the non-light. So you'd probably still come out ahead. But then we just have to see what happens with demand. It was a really clunky system originally that Suzuki Australia had where it would base the allocation of Jimnys on how successful a given dealer was in a previous period of time. So, you know, if a dealer was one of the biggest dealers, it would get a big chunk of supply. But that also meant that if you ordered from a big dealer and you were far down the list, you may take longer to get your car than if you ordered it from a little dealer. And so you had this really weird higgledy-piggledy situation where no one knew precisely how long they'd have to wait. Now there's a nationally tracked, you know, order base where you go into the slot where you order it and you stay there irrespective of actually which dealer you pick the car up from. So it's much cleaner and neater now. Suzuki obviously learned a lesson or two. And hopefully the light can speed up the delivery process a bit further.
If you let's just backtrack a bit before you bought the Jimny, which one would you have bought if you had that choice?
Well, given that the head unit in the normal Jimny is frankly not that great anyhow, it's about the cheapest off-the-shelf head unit you could possibly imagine. CarPlay works about half the time. And given I replaced the alloy wheels with steel wheels immediately because it's a 4x4 that should have them, I probably would have bought the light because I have a manual too. So I would have just bought the light. It would have made more sense for me. I would have, rather than having to buy new wheels and tyres for mine, I would have only had to have bought tyres. So it would have probably saved me even more money. The head unit, it's got Bluetooth. I'm a simple guy. Phone cradle, Waze running on the phone, Bluetooth for your streaming. I could live with that. Not everybody could though, but yeah, if it was me, I'd just buy the light. Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, well, we're going to touch on what we just spoke about in the introduction, Scully, about the Navara Pro 4X Warrior by Premcar. We might go into a little bit more detail with this car now. What have you got?
Nissan is back with a new Warrior, which is really, really cool because the first Warrior was a really interesting story and it was a story that could have gone one of two ways. a lot of investment came in from Nissan Australia, a lot of time came in from Nissan and from Premcar to turn the Navara into a much tougher, much more off-road capable, but also more comfortable on-the-road truck. And had it not been very well received by the media and by customers, it's unlikely they would have bothered doing it again. But as it turns out, the first Warrior was quite a good thing. It wasn't quite Ford Ranger Raptor levels, but it wasn't all that far off and really found a little niche for itself. And so Nissan has given Premcar even more freedom with this one. Premcar has learned some lessons from customers with this one. And we now have the 2022 Nissan Navara Pro 4X Warrior by Premcar. Whew, it's a long name.
A long badge to put on a car.
It is a long badge to put on a car.
Just call it the Navara Warrior, seriously. Yeah.
That is what we're going to call it from now on. And that's what we're called in our story too. It's going to be a full-time member of the Navara range. And like before, it's built in Thailand and then it comes off the line, is shipped to Premcar, who rips the wheels off, does the suspension, puts the new body bits on, and then it goes to Nissan dealers from there where it's backed by a five-year warranty. The formula is very similar to last time. The car's got a wider track than before. It rides 40 mil higher thanks to bigger wheels and tyres and a suspension lift. It's got a really tough looking front bumper with an integrated LED light bar. It's now powder coated and painted to make it more resistant to stone chips. And it's also got this time around an improved payload capacity. So the previous one would do 760 kilos. Now it'll do 950 with an automatic, which is on the back of feedback from customers. The stuff that hasn't really changed, it's been refined and tweaked, but the core sort of concepts are the same, is that it rides on a really sophisticated suspension designed to make the Warrior feel really planted and stable on the road. And the last Warrior definitely had a distinct feel about it. It kind of felt like long travel, like it could soak up lots of lumps and bumps, but the steering still felt quick. It still felt solid on the highway. The back end didn't want to go for a walk when you went round corners. Premcar has chased that same feeling with the new car, but it's refined how the individual bits of the suspension work so that the rear should be a little bit more tied down. They've changed what they call the jounce bumper, which is essentially a bit of the end of the suspension's travel so that when you're right near the bump stops, it can still control the body movement for off-roading. Lots of small detailed changes that are designed to make it a more cohesive car. It also looks tougher than before. And that last Warrior was a good-looking truck, but the front end of the old Navara was a little bit apologetic, whereas the new one has got these really tough new headlights, and Nissan's lent hard into that and given it a blacked-out grille, a more aggressive splash plate finished in red at the front. It now looks more like a car with the Warrior badge on there should as well. So Nissan and Premcar have essentially taken feedback from the first car, remembered what was good about it, and tried to create something better. And we didn't get a drive at the launch just yet, although more information is coming through about when we'll be able to do that soon is my understanding. But if it is like the last Warrior but improved again, this promises to be a really good thing. And given it undercuts the Ranger Raptor on price, a pretty cool way to get your tough truck kicks with outspending, what, 80-odd grand on a Raptor once you get on the road.
Yeah, I guess the downside of it compared to, say, an Amarok is still that engine, but it's not bad. And I think the fundamental is that the new updated 2021 Navara is a way better car. You know, it's got a steering wheel that doesn't have ergonomic nightmare all over it. It's got much tougher design. The NVH is improved. You know, it really moves that vehicle on. And the base car from which the Warrior begins is now what the Navara ought to have been from day one. And it's good to see because Nissan, the Navara used to be, you know, right up there with Ranger and Hilux in terms of sales and reputation. And in recent times, things like the D-Max have stolen its thunder a bit. So I think Nissan getting its mojo back in that market is only going to encourage that segment to get even more competitive, which is a great thing.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the engine, actually, because we did ask Premcar about that. Bernie Quinn, who's the head of engineering there and a really lovely guy who knows his stuff. I'd love to get him on the podcast, actually, because he speaks really well. But he sort of said that Premcar is able to get more power from the 2.3-litre engine. It could do it. It had worked 99% of the time. But if, for example, after having the car for 5 or 6 years, someone wants to tow a caravan up a really steep hill, stress caused by whatever power upgrades could eventually mean that the car is more likely to have a failure of some sort. So not saying that the engine is unreliable or would be unreliable, but just in the absolute extreme circumstances, it's harder to guarantee the reliability to the same point of the stock engine. So yeah, I think the focus has really been on the suspension because touching the engine opens up a whole new can of worms.
This is exactly what the OEM-backed process like this brings to the table. I mean, anyone can go to an aftermarket purveyor and put a chip in their engine and suddenly double their power output, but you don't have any idea what the longevity of it's going to be. This car has been ticked off by Nissan. It's got a full Nissan warranty. It is sold and, you know, backed like any other product, made in a proper factory. And I guess there are some trade-offs to that, which is they have to be just a bit more conservative. So you take the good with the bad, right?
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to move on to something completely different now. Volvo has released photos of its Recharge concept SUV, Moco. This is a very interesting design.
Yeah, Zach, our news writer, called it the manifesto for a pure electric future from Volvo, which I quite liked the wording of. And it is. So the company's confirmed the next XC60 and XC90 are going to be electric. You know, this is a company that is now gung-ho about making its whole range electric. Nothing wishy-washy about what Volvo is doing. And I guess this Recharge is sort of the concept that shows where its design and what its technology is going to look like over the next few years as its mainstream cars come into their type of replacement. And it's quite a simplified, stripped-back design. It's proportionally a little bit strange, I will say, but it's very, very, very sleek, clean, simple, very Scandinavian in the way it looks. And I think it's quite clear that these design hints and, you know, the taillights and the body sculpting and, you know, the very unusual D-pillar and all these things are going to carry over to the next iterations of some of its better-known nameplates. We also know that this concept and the production models that it sort of previews will use the now ubiquitous flat skateboard-style platform, so there'll be some packaging upsides. I don't think the concept's, you know, wild rear-opening back doors that give you a full pillarless side profile will carry over to production. If they do, I'll eat my hat. But, you know, even in terms of the interior design of this car and some of the autonomous things that it can do, it's got a LiDAR sensor on its roof, which is extraordinarily expensive but also necessary for having that really advanced level 3 and 4 autonomy. So it's really, I guess, a technological concept leader for the brand and sort of shows what's going to happen. In fact, I liked a line from Robin Page, the head of design, who said, inside the concept Recharge, we create a truly Scandinavian living room feeling. And I like that Volvo has realized that, you know, we're a luxury brand, but we shouldn't try and be the Germans. We should be who we are, which is Scandinavian, which comes at all of its own upsides. It really seems to embrace that, and I like that a lot. So, you know, Volvo is a brand on the up and up, and this sort of sleek, simplified EV concept really shows what it's all about.
That manifesto line is really rings true when you look at the Recharge in the context of everything else Volvo announced this morning as well. It's got the LiDAR sensor on the roof as part of what it's calling its new safety suite that all of its cars going forward will get that are going to be over-the-air updatable. And the way they interact with drivers is going to be different as well. Volvo wants them to be able to see accidents coming sooner and rather than warning the driver or stopping the car, help the driver avoid them more naturally. It's also said that it's going to offer a fully autonomous drive mode in its Highway Pilot, provided you're on a place where it's legally able to do it and it's the conditions allow for it. So Volvo has actually laid out its tech future, and the Recharge is kind of the physical form of that. It's talked about how it plans to offer 1,000 kilometres of range from electric car batteries by the end of the 2020s as part of a partnership with another Swedish battery supplier. It's going to bring all of its computing in its cars into one central brain that can then manage everything. So this really is Volvo laying a flag in the sand and saying, this is what our cars are going to look like in some form. Anyway, I realise that the XC90 is probably not going to be a wagon, van, SUV mashup with giant wheels, but a lot of what you see in the Recharge is going to inform the next generation of Volvos and really be quite closely linked to them, which is going to be really interesting to see.
I tell you what, though, if they've got a 1,000 kV with a LiDAR in the roof, that's going to be a $300,000 Volvo XC90. So it's going to be fascinating to see. And they're obviously going to leverage their supply agreements with their Chinese parent company, Geely Holding, and that's obviously going to yield some big cost savings through scale and amortization and things like that. So that'll help. But gee, these cars are going to be bloody expensive if they do everything they claim to do. So we'll have to keep an eye on, is Volvo going to become a Rolls-Royce competitor maybe? I'm not so sure. But, yeah, it'll be really fascinating to see what that brand does over the next few years.
Well, speaking of another brand we're keeping an eye on, especially in Australia, Honda Australia is now selling cars through an agency officially, well, as of when this podcast is being recorded, Scully.
Correct. We're about 17 hours after Honda's officially flicked the switch. We're recording at about 5 p.m. and it is now selling under an agency model in Australia, which we have talked about before on the podcast, but July 1 was the inflection point, and it has now officially happened. Honda's confirmed some more details about how it's going to sell these cars now that we've actually made the switch. There's going to be 90 locations called Honda Centers, which are essentially what dealerships used to be, but these are all going to be more tightly managed by head office. They're going to have a more cohesive aesthetic to them, and they're going to be managed by 47 different owners. So there'll still be some dealer groups that are involved in this, but obviously the people working the floor at the Honda Centers aren't necessarily going to be selling cars like they used to. They're going to have more of a focus on customer service. 30 of those locations are going to be in urban areas, 60 in rural Australia, and it's actually not all that much of a shrinking footprint compared to what Honda used to have. Before it announced the switch, it had 106 dealers. So 16 fewer is definitely a step, you know, in the direction of smaller, but Honda's not gone back to a couple of showrooms and is not forcing people to cover huge distance. It's likely just killed a few dealerships that were on the edge of different market areas that were maybe overlapping. The shift to the Honda Center has been backed by a new configurator online, and there's a new, what Honda's calling, experience platform, which sounds quite similar to something we've done at Car Expert. And it'll store vehicle info, it'll let owners make service bookings, and it'll keep track of the car's history, and you can do it all through the website. The idea being that once you are an owner, Honda has a closer relationship with you and you can manage stuff in different ways. And yeah, Honda is essentially saying that, you know, this is its first step towards focusing on what it's calling an end-to-end customer experience. It's something that we've seen in a lot of other industries, and overseas other brands have done this as well, but Honda is essentially the first mover of its scale in Australia. Mercedes-Benz will follow next year. Cupra will also be agency sold next year. And I mean, we're forever hearing rumors of other brands doing it, but we haven't actually seen it happen yet. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out and whether people resonate with this idea of no haggle pricing, fixed service costs, which are really sharp. It's $125 per service for the first five services. So Jesus. 5 years of maintenance on a Civic is dirt cheap. Honda's also going to pare back its range, which we've talked about. The Civic will live on. We're going to get the new Civic hatchback, including a hybrid and the Type R. We're going to get the new HRV, likely late this or early next year. The CRV has just been updated. And then the Odyssey is actually likely to end next year. We didn't know this at the time of we first reported the agency model, but the Japanese factory that builds it is closing down, and Honda has said that this current model's life will end in 2022 and there won't be any more of it from there. So it's going to have a pared back range in Oz. It's going to be really interesting to see how it goes.
There are two really good upsides to the agency model, and it's caused a lot of, I guess, angst among dealer groups. And we saw some really interesting things at a federal Senate inquiry where a former Honda dealer really teed off at its treatment at the hands of Honda and, you know, alleged a lot of things. But from a customer perspective, this does two things. One, inventory is now centralized. So rather than every single dealer, you know, rather than an OEM like Honda wholesaling all of its stock to different dealers, and you know the old story, if you go to a dealer and say, I want a blue Civic, and they go, we don't have one, and I might be able to do you a favor and speak to the dealer up the road and source you one, that doesn't happen anymore because the centralized database of vehicles is national. And every single sales point is just they access the same portal. So, you know, you can see nationally what vehicles are on the ground. And the other one is, you know, guaranteed price. You pay what you pay. You know exactly what you're going to pay. There are some people who haggle, who love the haggle, who love to get a few grand off, but there are some people who are frankly terrified of it. They feel like they're probably going to get taken advantage of or sharked by a sleazy car salesman. So the fact that, you know exactly what you're going to pay, and the fact that you can access the entire national database of vehicles from anywhere in the country are real upsides for buyers as I see it. That doesn't mean it's a perfect model. But I think as a consumer, there's a lot to like about it. And I sort of think for all of its flaws, Honda's probably quite brave to be the first major OEM to actually go down this path in Australia.
If you would like to have a say on anything we've spoken about in the news, you can email podcast@carexpert.com.au and hit up the website if you want to read more too. Scully, the Havel H2 will no longer be. Becoming in its place is the Jolyon. What a jolly name. What is the Jolyon and what are its rivals?
The Jolyon is another SUV from China. It's priced in line with cars like the Hyundai Venue, the Kia Stonic, the MG ZST, and at the lower end, the MG HS. Mitsubishi ASX is in there as well, and it's a really strong seller. But it's actually, on paper, very similar in size to a Kia Seltos or even the now-replaced Kia Sportage. It's quite a big car, but it's priced in line with smaller, less well-equipped cars, which has been something we've seen from a few Chinese brands as they try to find a foothold in Australia.
So what pricing are we looking at for this?
So the range starts at $25,490 for the Jolyon Premium. We tested the Jolyon Luxe, which was $27,990, and the most you'll pay is $39,90 drive away. All of those cars come really, really well equipped. So even the base model has a 10.25-inch touchscreen with CarPlay and Android Auto, a reversing camera, power folding mirrors, auto wipers, keyless entry, all the stuff you usually have to pay more for in more established brands' cars. The Lux that we had pretty much everything you could need. So LED headlights, daytime running lights and fog lights, leather steering wheel, leatherette, so fake leather seat trim, six-speaker sound system, heated seats, a digital instrument cluster, pretty much everything.
Wow.
And then if you pay more again, you get a 12.3-inch screen on the Ultra, along with wireless phone charging, head-up display, and a panoramic sunroof. So all of the basics are covered even from the base model, but I think the mid-range Lux is probably the best mix of all of them. I personally don't need a panoramic sunroof and a bigger screen, and the dials were fine in the car we had.
Yeah, it's so. Because you're 16 feet tall, mate, and you don't have the headroom.
Exactly. I don't need to be getting a haircut from a glass roof all the time.
What does it do well?
What it does well is have a lot of space. Okay. This is a big car, and you look at it in person and it's a bit deceptive because it rides on quite small wheels, and it's sort of it's a much better looking car than the H2, but it still doesn't have a massive bold presence about it in the way that maybe some bigger cars do. But then you sit in it and you realize that it is genuinely huge. It's got a massive boot that'll take golf clubs with the driver still left in there. You've got a really good driving position up front. With the exception of the fact the steering wheel doesn't telescope, it only moves up and down, which is a real oversight in 2021. Mm. And it's got really, really good rear seat space. So you could sit an adult behind someone like Mike or me who are tall. And, I mean, maybe you'd want a bigger car for long trips, but you could do it much better than you could in the back of an ASX. And having spent a bit of time in the back of Mitsubishi ASX Ubers, anything bigger than that is going to be good. So I think the one thing that the Havel does really well to start with is the fact that it packs in a lot of car for your money. But beyond that, we're well past the point now where all we could say about Chinese cars or cars at this end of the market are that they have a lot of equipment for the cash, because the Jolyon actually puts up a really good fist of not only having the equipment but making it attractive and making it work well. The interior is a nice place to spend time, like steering wheel aside. All of the bits you touch and sort of lean on feel of the sort of quality you would expect of a $27,500 car. The tech is generally pretty good. It's pretty quick to respond, although there's some menus that are a bit small and there's some weirdness there, like the driver's heated seat button is actually on the left of the screen, not the right, because they haven't swapped it over for right-hand drive.
Wow.
So there's some little things like that that, I mean, someone in China is probably already working on the code to fix it. But for the most part, it's not just a car that you have to buy because you feel like you're getting a lot of stuff for your money. The stuff you are getting actually feels pretty well put together and feels like it's been, you know, done with some thought.
Yeah, there's something that I want to add there, Scully, which you talk about there's probably someone in China already making the corrections. I want to give you an example of this. And I don't want to sound like a fanboy for the brand, but I found this fascinating, which was when GWM, which is the same company as Haval, launched the new pickup that it sells, the Ute, at the start of the year, a lot of people, us included, said the throttle calibration's way off. You know, you put your foot down and absolutely nothing happens until you're at about three-quarter travel, and then you get everything at once, and it creates a surging driving dynamic. That feedback obviously went back to Baoding. The latest shipment of GWM products that just arrived 6 months later have got completely different software calibration, and that can be retroactively applied to existing products, which tells me that these companies have a certain kind of agility. They're not waiting for the mid-cycle update to make these sort of iterative changes. They're actually just doing it on the fly. And I think the thing you'll find with stuff like the Jolyon is that sort of feedback. I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of those things were addressed on the fly and they weren't really spoken about. The other one was I took that Jolyon for a quick drive and it had some flaws. But one of the things that really impressed me was I found a horribly corrugated, ungraded gravel road, and I barreled over it at the 100k an hour speed limit for as long as I humanly could, and not a single squeak or rattle could I find. which told me that it was really well put together. You know, often you find cars start to really show their weaknesses once you actually make them a little bit uncomfortable. I didn't get that sense with this car at all. It remained quiet and felt tight as a drum even after that, which, flaws aside, tells me that it's not badly built at the very least.
That's probably a good segue into how it drives, because at this end of the market, we've come to expect that base model cars will have a pretty anemic 2-litre petrol engine. The Volkswagen Group is the exception to that, but even the Volkswagen T-Cross and the Skoda Kamiq, they get a 1.4 or 1.5-litre engine with, a 1-litre engine in some cases, with about 85 kilowatts of power at this sort of price point. So the other thing with the Jolyon is it's powered by a 1.5-litre turbocharged engine, and it's got more punch than you might expect of a bottom-end SUV. We're kind of used to these cars having pretty anemic sort of naturally aspirated engines and CVTs, and you really have to work them hard to feel like you're getting anywhere quickly. The Jolyon's got a 1.5-litre turbocharged engine with 110 kilowatts and 210 newton meters, and it's got a 7-speed dual-clutch transmission. So on paper, it's not a hot hatch or anything like that, but what it does have is a nice little shove in the back off the mark. And when you put your foot down on the move or at speed, it doesn't need to work nearly as hard as some of the other entry-level engines that you might expect in this class. The dual-clutch transmission is also really good, and that's not always the case with small displacement engines in small cars. Often they can be a little bit jerky, they can not like taking off on hills, they don't interact well with start-stop, that sort of thing, but like taking off on slippery hills, doing reverse parks uphill with traffic behind you, all the stuff that these transmissions often struggle with. The Jolyon actually did a really, really good job of. It felt smooth off the mark. It felt smooth when it was changing. It hunts around a little bit more for gears than maybe it needs to. It could be a bit more confident in itself and not drop down a gear sometimes. But for the most part, it's a really sophisticated powertrain, especially when you consider, again, what you're paying for the car. Mm. Kia makes you buy the more expensive Seltos to get the 1.6-litre turbo engine. Mitsubishi does a bigger displacement, naturally aspirated engine in the top-end ASX. You can't get a more powerful engine in the Hyundai Venue. So the Jolyon actually has something that not all that many of its rivals do, and that's a pretty punchy turbocharged engine from the word go. Even cars that do have a similar sort of engine, like the Skoda Kamiq or the Volkswagen T-Cross, have an 85 kilowatt engine. So the Jolyon's got a bit of punch, and the fact it's bigger and has more weight to pull is probably part of that. But I think also Havel's been quite clever in just making it really simple for customers and making them walk into the dealership, which, if you're a brand that people don't necessarily know about, is a hard thing to do to start with. And once they're there, just going, you can have it with no leather, you can have it with leather, you can have it with the sunroof. Because as soon as you add too much more complication in there, people might get overwhelmed and walk out and go, I don't care, I'm buying a Toyota instead. So I can understand why Havel's done it. And I think people paying 25 grand for a car with this engine are real winners. Mm. I wouldn't be relying on the paddles all that much. They're not particularly snappy.
Oh,
and they're
it has
in a bit
paddles.
Of a,
wow.
It, absolutely, Mandy, it has paddles. Absolutely it does. You're
it's
an F1
question.
Driver. But yeah, it's a really good engine for a car of this price, and it's quiet and refined on the highway. Like Mike said, it actually rides really well as well. Mm. Again, it's not quite perfect. There's another 5 or 10 degrees of refinement that could be maybe made there. It could feel a little bit quicker, the steering off the mark. It could be a little bit better over sharp small bumps and sort of feel a little bit more plush and relaxed over them. But I sort of remember writing this review and going, oh, it could do this and it could do that. And then looking at that price and just going, but for 27.5 grand, what else comes close? And it really is quite a unique car in that the amount of space it offers, the amount of performance it offers, and the amount of tech it offers for that price. So all these negatives, I think, would be, you know, pretty pressing if the car costs 35 grand. But at 27.5 drive away, I can understand why you'd overlook them, because it is a lot of car and it is a really well-resolved car for that money.
The big problem with these vehicles, and I've had a few people ask me already in recent times, should I buy the Chinese, you know, be it the MG or be it the Haval? It's just not even reputation. It's just longevity in the market. Mm. You know, there is such a thing as earning your stripes. And while Haval is enormous in China and it sells more than 1 million cars a year there, it doesn't really have runs on the board in Australia yet. Great Wall kind of has some runs on the board making really cheap and basic utes, which is not what the new stuff is going for. So there is definitely a part of me, that would say to somebody, you know what? there's still an argument for buying the ASX, even if it's not as good, because at least you know exactly what you're going to get. And the only way that Haval can get over that and get through that is just to give it time. I would say another negative that I really need to point out is the lack of an ANCAP crash rating. It's got absolutely all the active, it's got all the active safety tech under the sun, but none of ANCAP or GWM's products yet have, or current products, I should say, that's some previous products did, but current products, none of them have that coveted ANCAP rating of any sort. So 5-star or 1-star, they've got nothing. They are going to be tested by ANCAP, and in the next few months, we should see the results come through. But I can't look you in the eye and say, I promise you this car is going to be safe until I've actually seen an independent crash test. So absolutely, I would argue that is a vital thing. And I would also advise you to potentially hold off until that comes through.
Scully, is it affordable to maintain, I suppose, service?
Yeah, so service pricing isn't all that wild compared to rivals or compared to what you'd expect. It's also not dirt cheap in the same way that new Honda stuff is on the back of our conversation in news, but the service intervals are every 12 months or 15,000 kilometres, and you'll pay $210, $250, $350, $450, and then $290 for the first 5 services. So okay, there's nothing there that's going to send you broke, but it's also not quite as cheap as Toyota or the new Honda plan. What the Havel does have is a 7-year unlimited kilometre warranty, and that might allay some people's fears. I realise a warranty is not worth much if the brand packs up and leaves the country, but the fact that Havel backs the car for 7 years and it's been around for a little while now should also go some way to allaying people's fears that maybe the car's going to fall apart on them. Because with these brands, like Mike was saying, you do need to do a lot more work to get people over the line because they don't have the reputation.
What car expert rating did you give it, Scully?
So I've given it a 7.8 out of 10. And the reason for that is, for one, we didn't have the car for all that long. We had a good little drive in it, but more time is required to really get a feel for it in some other conditions. But it uses 8.5 litres per 100 Ks, which is quite thirsty for a small car. And there's still some bits and pieces in the technology and in the way it handles that we'd like to see improved. But, I mean, value for money is so strong that it really, you know, it really makes a strong case for itself.
We'll move slightly off topic now, but remain with Havel. Moko, you've been following Chinese brands very closely in Australia as some have made their way from basically unknown to being in the top 10 selling brands. Mm-hmm. What has shifted Australia's thinking of not particularly trusting Chinese brands to now seeing them on the road every day? I suppose the first one that comes to mind is MG.
Price and supply and semi-decent design with good warranties would probably be the short answer. So we know that at the moment there are these massive stock issues around the world, not only COVID shutting factories and all of the lag issues that affect Australia being at the end of the supply queue, but also semiconductor shortages around the world. The just-in-time model of building cars and sourcing components really backfired on the industry when global demand for vehicles dropped. Semiconductor supplies dropped, and when car brands pulled the lever to get hold of them, there was nothing in the kitty to provide them anymore because they'd all been allocated to other industries. So semiconductors that basically power active safety systems and touchscreens and all of the digital stuff in vehicles are not available, which means stock issues are rampant. You know, most brands in the market, we just published a great piece on the site talking about this, the majority of car brands now have far less stock than demand would require, which causes waiting lists. But hey, guess what? The Chinese brands don't seem to have any of those issues, be it MG or be it LDV, although LDV has had a few supply issues, I will say, or GWM, formerly known as Great Wall, or Haval. Chinese-made Tesla Model 3s and Volvos, we're really not seeing those same shortfalls. And MG was a great example where they've got a ship coming into New South Wales with only its products on it. They're not sharing it with any other brand. So the Chinese manufacturers are leveraging this supply to their advantage because you might not want to wait 8 months for your Toyota RAV4, so you might just buy a Haval H6 instead. It may not be your priority, but if you can get it now, that might just be that extra thing that gets you over the line. When you consider how much better the products have actually become over the past 10 years and how good the warranties are and the design is and all these sorts of things, that supply issue might be the final piece in the puzzle that's required.
Now you say that you're able to get your hands on maybe an MG3 or an MGHS or a Haval Jolyon. When can I get my hands on a Haval Big Dog or an Aura Good Cat? That's what I want to know, Mike.
Yeah, so there's some language crossover issues here, aren't there? There's some products sold, particularly by the GWM brand, in China that, you know, I'm sure the naming makes a whole lot of sense in Mandarin. Maybe it doesn't work so well in English. So the company has confirmed that it is heavily investigating launching the Haval Big Dog, which is
I love it so much.
It honestly reminds me of a Mercedes GLB or even a Ford Bronco Sport. It's a real tough, chunky looking SUV, but it's based on the H6, which is China's most popular SUV of any sort. So it's based on a, which is sort of like a Nissan X-Trail, Mazda CX-5 sized soft SUV, but it looks super tough. And the interior, it's bloody nice. Like GWM poached really well-known designers and engineers from most of the big German brands and has basically poured a bottomless amount of money into making products and has a ridiculously over-indexed number of R&D people as part of its overall supply staffing situation. And the result of that is products that will actually surprise the hell out of you. I know you just drove the Haval Jolly on, Scott, so you can back up what I'm talking about here. And the Big Dog's design, yeah, the name is a bit stupid, but the design, it looks great. It really does. And on that note, there's another car that's in the works. It's called the Tank 300. GWM has turned Tank into its own sub-brand, at least in China. Whether it would be called Haval here, I don't really know just yet. But it's a body-on-frame 4x4 based on the GWM Ute. It's got locking diffs at the front and the rear. It's got various crawl modes, a bit like a Prado. It's a proper tough machine. I actually drove it off-road briefly because they flew a left-hand drive one out for evaluation purposes. And I can tell you, places I got bogged in a Mitsubishi Triton, I walked over in this thing. I can't say much more than that. But laugh at Chinese. I guess the catch of this is laugh at Chinese products at your peril. People used to laugh at Korean cars too. They used to laugh at Japanese cars too, remember? China's just the next wave of that, only China's even bigger and richer than either of them, and the products are getting better at a rate of knots. And now that they're backed by good designs, good warranties, and good supply, man, you better watch out. Every other car brand better watch out. That's all I'll say.
So BYD is a massive electric car force in China that we now know is coming to Australia. One of my overriding memories of going to China with Haval a couple of years ago was all the electric cars that we don't get in Australia. Is there a chance that we'll start seeing Aura products in Oz? And if so, which ones are likely to come?
Yeah, glad you mentioned that. So GWM, again, I should clarify, GWM is the parent brand, Great Wall, Haval, Aura Tank. There's all these sub-brands that it sells products under. Aura, O-R-A, is the name of its electric car brand. It's got numerous little electric city hatches and things like that. And from 2023 is the current plan to launch those vehicles here. The thing about Haval or GWM is that it's still a privately owned company. And the guy that runs it, he wants to take over the world. Now, that's obviously has positives and negatives to it, of course, but it does mean that there's less bureaucracy, there's less red tape. It's just one guy making most of the decisions, and he has said that he wants to take over the Australian market. So what that means is things will be greenlit for Australia that other manufacturers might not. Volkswagen, for instance, says, well, we can't justify selling EVs here for a few years. I don't think that's going to be an issue for this company because it will just make it happen because it wants to, because taking over China is one thing, but dominating on the world scale comes with lots of pride, and that's what's really motivating this company as far as I can see. It's not going to take a massive haircut in terms of money. It's not going to hemorrhage money to do it, but it will probably do it on a skinnier business case than most, and the Aura EVs are a big part of that. So 2023-ish, again, whether it retains the Aura good cat and punk cat and all these weird names remains to be seen. I don't like the chances of them selling vehicles with those names if they try.
Marco, can you see a time when Chinese brands will overtake the ever popular Japanese brands at all? Because as you said before, Korean cars were looked down upon many years ago in Australia.
Look, MG's already in the top 10. MG already outsells Honda and Suzuki. I think the Haval and GWM products are better than the MG products. I think they feel more cohesive. I think they have fewer flaws. And they're just as keenly priced. And I see no reason, you know, MG has the advantage because it's got the known brand. Haval, GWM, who the hell knows what that even is? And that's obviously an impediment. But look, we saw the Chinese manufacturers grow at a rate of knots last year. It's even bigger this year. The company projects 18,000 sales this year, which is up fourfold. You just replicate that again next year and suddenly bang. So look, I think it's entirely feasible that by 2023, 2024, there'll be two or three Chinese companies in the top 10. And I think there are a number of Japanese and Korean companies in particular that really need to watch out. Because, you know, perceptions, they change. They really do. And there's obviously geopolitical considerations, and there are some people that wouldn't buy a Chinese product no matter what, but there are plenty of people that just don't care. And I reckon the latter is the majority. So, yeah, to answer your question, I absolutely can see it.
Can you imagine the Toyota being knocked off first place? That would be incredible to see.
We're a while away from Toyota being knocked off. But if I was, I don't know, if I was Honda or Mitsubishi or Subaru, I'd be a little bit more concerned.
Yeah, for sure.
The day Toyota's knocked off on top of the sales charts is the day our servers melt.
Well,
Car Expert burns to the ground.
In 1997, they would have said the same thing about Holden, wouldn't they?
That's very true. Absolutely.
Extremely true, yeah. You can read more up at carexpert.com.au. Always love doing car comparisons on the podcast, Marco. You're the king of comparisons, really. You've put the Mazda MX-30 up against the Toyota CHR, two Japs head-to-head. Well, they're crossovers, aren't they?
Very much so. Yeah. And yes, dear listener, you did hear Mandy correctly. She said MX-30, not CX-30, because the company's got both. So the MX-30 is this new, weird, quirky four-door crossover SUV, but it's got the rear opening freestyle doors, the pillarless side profile, the sort of sharply raked GT-style rear, the heavy reliance on green interior materials like cork grown from sustainable trees and, you know, trims made from PET bottles and the banishment of solvents from the production process of all the different leather touch points. So I found that quite an interesting proposition and had no idea what the hell to test it against, because it's such a strange car. The mid-grade one, 36,490 for the touring variant as a mild hybrid. Well, the car that came to mind was the Toyota CHR full hybrid, because that too is a quirky, sporty-looking crossover SUV that puts design ahead of practicality every day of the week, gives you the slightly elevated ride height. But unlike the Mazda, and Mazda keeps talking about the hybrid nature of the MX-30, even though on paper it doesn't appear to be much more than a glorified stop-start system, the Toyota CHR hybrid is a real hybrid. So I thought, you know, this is a chance to test two design-led quirky SUVs that have green credentials about them, and maybe let's just see which is best.
Which design do you think will date well? Because they're both very quirky designs.
Yeah, look, design is so subjective, but I've never really warmed to the CHR's look. There are plenty of people who love it and dig it, and it sells 1,000 a month. And CHR stands for Coupe High Rider, and that really is a pretty good way to explain what this car is. I don't personally love the look, but who cares what I think about the look of a car, right? Because for everyone that dislikes it, there's someone who does like it. The MX-30 is really, really interesting. Those rear doors alone, just like an old RX-8, are fascinating to me. I think it's an extraordinarily distinctive looking car. It looks like nothing else on the road. Plenty of people really hate it, but I actually really dig it. So, yeah, I would choose the Mazda as a style statement personally, yeah.
Do they compare pretty closely with technology or equipment?
Yeah, they do. So they're very similarly equipped. The Koba is the specification of CHR hybrid, just under 38 grand RRP. So both these cars are around that $40,000-ish mark on the road. And both of them are very well equipped with modern infotainment systems, really nice materials and trims used inside, the active safety equipment that you expect in cars these days. Not a huge amount of differentiation when it comes to spec, and both are pretty luxuriously equipped.
So, Moco, Toyota is known as the hybrid brand, but Mazda is pushing this M-hybrid thing pretty hard with the MX-30. What do they actually mean by M-hybrid? Because it doesn't really seem like the same thing as what Toyota's doing.
No, it's pure buzzwordery at its finest. This is not a hybrid car, and Mazda should be hauled over the coals for calling it one. M-hybrid, what it means is an integrated starter generator and a 24-volt electrical system, so a very, 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 very small amount of regenerative charge regenerative braking charge can be stored on board, which can add a small amount of punch on acceleration and also smooths out the stop-start system. So the stop-start system kicks in when you're still rolling, which is obviously where stop-start systems become maddening, is when you stop and then the car jolts, and then it jolts when it starts up again. This gets rid of all that. But it's still a 2-litre naturally aspirated petrol engine with a high compression ratio, and very, very minor electrification. I used mid-sevens, 7.5 litres of fuel every 100 Ks, which is not inefficient, but it's no less, or I should say no more efficient than a CX-30 without all this stuff in 2-litre incarnation. The difference is 0.1 litres every 100 Ks. And the CX-30 is a bigger car. So this M-hybrid stuff, it improves the smoothness of the drive because the stop-start is a bit nicer. But in terms of economy gains, there are none to be found. On the other hand, it does have some environmental cred on account of all those interesting materials and trims and recycled things that I mentioned before. So it does have something going for it there. It's a lovely drivetrain. It's quite perky. It's quite characterful. It's got that typical willingness to really be revved hard, just like aspirated engines tend to have. But just don't call it a hybrid because it's not. On the other hand, the CHR is a hybrid. It can drive at car park speeds as a pure electric vehicle. It starts up in complete silence. You know, the hardest part for a car and the least energy efficient part of a car is takeoff, because all that weight has to get moving. That's where the electric motor in the hybrid Toyota really shines. The fuel use was 4.3 litres every 100 Ks. So wow. There was a massive gulf in fuel use. So it really does show you what a proper hybrid versus a buzzword hybrid actually does.
While we're talking about Mazda branding, this is badged as an MX model. Does it handle like a sports car or more like an MX than maybe the CX-30 or the CX-3?
So MX Mazda Experiment is what that's short for. Obviously, it denotes a wide variety of things in the Mazda brand, but the previous two holders of the badge, the MX-5 and MX-6, are both sports cars, right? So it does handle really well. It's obviously a bit higher, has a bit of a slightly elevated position over a sports car. So there is going to be a little bit more body roll, but at the end of the day, it's actually pretty nippy. It's got that beautiful Mazda steering wheel, head-up display, quite a low slung seating position, really nice ride quality. The G-vectoring system that basically cuts engine delivery to improve, you know, cornering and to mitigate understeer works really, really subtly. The steering is nicely weighted. It is a really lovely car to drive. I wouldn't say it's a track terror like a rear-wheel drive MX-5 is, but as far as these sort of style statement crossovers go, yes, it is very good to drive. But it also has to be said, so is the CHR. So Toyota's CHR is based on this new modular TNGA architecture with quite sophisticated rear suspension, quite a stiff chassis. Akio Toyota, the boss of Toyota, is a race car driver, and he's demanded that modern Toyotas don't drive like white goods on wheels anymore, and they don't. The CHR is pretty much as agile and nimble to drive as the MX-30, despite having a bulkier hybrid system. And I would say both of these cars are absolutely in the upper echelon when it comes to fun-to-drive character in this segment.
Which one does cabin space better?
CHR wins in that area. The MX-30's doors look great because there's no center pillar or B pillar and the rear door opens backwards, so you get this massive space. At least that's what appears to be. But in reality, the back seats are best for kids. It is pretty pokey. The CHR is not exactly a packaging marvel itself. It's got tiny, tiny side windows and quite a low rear roof, so headroom is a bit limited for someone of my proportions, for instance. But if you had to buy one of these cars gun to your head as a family option, you'd go the CHR. But in all honesty, if you're buying a crossover for practicality purposes, you'd be mad to buy either of these, in truth. Neither of them excel when it comes to packaging.
So which one won?
Look, it's a really tough call. I think it depends on how you look at it. I think Toyota's obviously the more efficient and more practical vehicle here. But I think the Mazda's a bit of a special product. I don't like the naming of it as an M-hybrid car, but if what these vehicles are supposed to be is a unique, interesting, left-of-center, head-turning, small SUV style statement for empty nesters with a premium sort of feel, then the Mazda does that better. Its interior is much nicer in terms of tactility, touch points, design. It's much more quirky and interesting to look at. Efficiency aside, the way it drives is at least as good, if not better, than the Toyota. So, you know, I would drive away in the Mazda. if I was choosing between these two cars, which in this instance I am. So look, I don't think it's a gospel result. I think there are things that make the CHR quite good. But against what we set out to achieve with this test, which is what is the best quirky, strange, unusual style statement SUV you can buy for 40 grand, in that instance, the Mazda is the one that impressed me more.
Fantastic. That comparison will be live at the site in coming weeks.
That's right. It won't be live immediately. There's a few ahead of it in the queue, but it will lob very shortly.
There goes another Car Expert podcast. Scully, what cars can we look forward to in the garage over the next week?
So at the moment, we have got the Mazda MX-30 E35, the pure electric version, which we're not allowed to talk about just yet, sitting in the garage. It's beautiful in soul crystal red. The Kia Cerato S hatchback I'm driving, and James Wong is driving the Volvo XC90 Recharge plug-in hybrid. We've also got a Ford Escape Vignale and a Volkswagen Tiguan 162 TSI Elegance for a comparison that Mike is working on. Coming in the next few weeks up in Queensland, they're going to get a spin in the MX-30. Sydney's going to see the Mazda CX-9 GT and the new Volkswagen Passat 206 TSI R-Line. Tony Crawford's enjoying that one, and I think he'll have some fun because he loves a good wagon. And in Melbourne, we've got a couple of mid-sized sporty sedans, a Genesis G70 and a BMW 320. We've got the Mitsubishi Pajero Sport, the SsangYong Rexton, and the Land Rover Defender 110 SD250, which I can't wait to have a look at.
Mate, there's no chance in hell you're going to drag Paul Maritch out of that thing.
I have horse.
Mauricio has had his eye on one of these for a long time, and he is going to pull rank on you, my friend.
I'm going to run down to the garage and deflate his tyres or something so he can't drive away in it and then inflate them and drive home, something nefarious like that.
Scott Colley and Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Mandy. Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.